And you're listening to Saturday Morning Live. This is Mally, a.k.a. Docu Vixen, and it is 11 o'clock. So what we have for you today is a back vintage Saturday Morning Live. I believe this interview was in 2003. So this is an interview with Angela Gilliam. And it's an interview about Cabral. And we're going to go right to that as soon as I make sure. So we're going to go right to that, and we will be back.
Going on. He played on Mercy Mercy Me and Inner City Blues. Babbitt replaced the legendary bassist James Jamerson, who Jay Rich called the greatest bass player of all time. Babbitt also played on I Want to Testify by the Parliaments, which featured George Clinton and former Temptation Ray Davis. Bob Babbitt plays bass on What's Going on the soundtrack Standing in the Shadows of Motown. It has been nominated for a Grammy this year. Find out what's going on Monday, February 17th at 12 p.m. on CKLN FM 88.1. And you're listening to CKLN. We're going to go straight to Miss Gilliam as opposed to Jane Cortez because of time constraints. Hi, my name is Norman Otis Richmond. This is the January 25th, 2003 edition of Saturday Morning Live. We're getting ready to speak about Amir Carl Cabral, who was assassinated 30 years ago on January the 20th, 1973. And joining me on the line from Olympia, Washington is Angela Gilliam. And Angela Gilliam is an anthropologist at the Evergreen State College. That's in Olympia, Washington. On the Pacific Coast, whose professional work has focused on the intersection of race, gender, and class in cultures throughout the world. Ms. Gilliam has a chapter in the book Black Feminist Anthropology. Ms. Gilliam, how are you doing?
I'm fine. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, it's wonderful to have you on the line. And Mr. Horn, Gerald Horn, sends his regards.
Thank you very much. He's a very important figure in terms of the intellectual production he has worked on through the years.
He basically says the same thing about you.
Thank you.
All right. So January 20th, 1973, Mr. Cabral, who was the leader of the party in Portuguese Guinea, so-called Portuguese Guinea, Guinea-Bissau, and the Cape Verde Islands, was assassinated. And he was regarded as one of the greatest theoreticians that ever lived. He was referred to himself as a simple African man. Let me get the direct quote. I'm a simple African man doing my duty in my own country in the context of our time. Now, Mr. Cabral was born in 1924. He was assassinated in 1973. But I understand you had an opportunity to meet Mr. Cabral in 1972. Now, he spoke in Harlem October 20th, 1972. I was supposed to be at that meeting myself, but I, for unforeseen circumstances, I could not attend. But you were there, and you remember talking to Mr. Cabral. First of all, could you talk about that, Mr. Cabral? What you think about him?
Well, I'm so glad that you mentioned my favorite quote. I really like that quote that he delivered, because I think it represented in many ways the way many of us felt. We were trying to say, how do we define ourselves in this particular complicated time? And I remember when I first read that, I'm just a simple African man trying to and here I'm paraphrasing, be true to my historical moment on this planet, it seemed to resonate for a lot of us who were in that room. We were kind of cramped in this, that is, it was standing room only, in this particular hall during that time that he spoke. And I remember he was explaining to us the complexities of the revolutionary struggles that were taking place in Africa at that time. And afterwards, I had occasion to actually ask him a question about language, because that has always been one of my focuses. I've always been interested in the impact of African language and culture in former colonial plantation economies, especially those that had conflict. So I had those questions in the back of my mind, and I asked him about the language that children in Guinea-Bissau and Cabo Verde were just, you know, were going to learn in school. And he thought, well, they needed to learn, you know, an international language. It could be any language as long as they were getting access to education. And I remember having a disagreement with him right there on the spot, saying that I think every child has the right to learn the language that, or to at least begin school in the language they think in. And what do you say to that? And basically he asked me if I would write him a letter about it. He gave me his address in Guinea-Conakry, because he couldn't be in Guinea-Bissau at the time. He had to only stay in Guinea-Conakry, which was a neighboring former French colony. And I kept preparing myself and writing and researching, and finally when I had the moment when I thought, okay, now I feel I have a position that's more thorough, that I can articulate and send to Cabral, that's when he was assassinated. I'll never forget the lesson that that afforded me, that we often think we're not ready, women especially, you know, that we have to prepare ourselves in extraordinary ways. And this was a moment, a lost opportunity for exchange with an extremely important figure of the 20th century.
Yeah, that's definitely a moving story. And my name is Norman Otis Richmond. The name of this show is Saturday Morning Live, and we're discussing the life of Amilcar Cabral. Today the spotlight is on Amilcar Cabral. I'm in conversation with Mrs. Angela Gilliam, who is has a chapter in the book Black Feminist Anthropology, and she is a professor at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. Now, nation language is something that I tend to agree with you, because I have been living among, you know, various people around the world for more than half my life, and one of the things I appreciate about Caribbean people is that, you know, they never have given up their so-called, their patois, which I think is a legitimate language. I think Mrs. Liu, a great Jamaican poet, talked about nation language, and I think it was George Bernard Shaw that talked about it as, you know, basically how, as long as you can understand somebody, it's a language, and basically what defines a language is an army. If you have an army to back up your language, then it is a language. If you don't have an army, people can tell you that you don't have a language. How do you relate to that?
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. For one thing, I look at the African continent to give evidence to the assertion you just made. Afrikaans, that is the language in South Africa, which it was always a mixed language. You have a tendency to think of Afrikaans as being exclusively of Dutch origin, but Afrikaans has Malay, vestiges of several African languages mixed in that have been changed and transformed over time. And when I was in South Africa in 1999, I was able to see that a lot of indigenous people speak Afrikaans, influenced by their own national or ethnic languages. So Afrikaans is not just a Boer, quote-unquote, language. However, Afrikaans did celebrate in the 70s. I remember it's a 100th year anniversary. And with great fanfare, I read about it in the Newsweek or, you know, a news magazine in the United States. And they were talking about the importance of the poetry and how certain writers who were like Brighton Breitenbach, who write in Afrikaans, how they represent something special in terms of the evolution of the claims of white South Africans to South Africa. And I happen to really like Brighton Breitenbach's work because he's very progressive and was in exile himself for several years. And I also believe that any, you know, that people who were born in a place can say that they are from that place. But nonetheless, the question of the power of the Afrikaner and the power of the Afrikaner in a certain part of the 20th century to stake a claim on Afrikaans as being the language that represented them was backed up with guns. And so this issue is very interesting. In the meantime, when you go to Swahili-speaking countries on the eastern part of Africa, Swahili is the 11th most widely spoken language in the world. And
I didn't know that.
Huh?
I didn't know it was. I didn't know that. That's a good, very good point. I learned something from you today. I didn't know it was that high on the list.
Yes, but people there have another approach to evolving that language because they have not had state power for more than 40 or 50 years. So these are interesting issues, I think.
Okay, I'm speaking to Angela Gilliam, and she has a chapter in the book Black Feminist Anthropology. I'm going to turn you over very shortly to a brother by the name of Adrian Harewood. He has some questions to ask you, but in that speech that Mr. Cabral made in October of 1972, he talked about the concept of comrades and brothers, and he talked about it would be good for people to be brothers and comrades, and the whole question of a comrade is something that is a positive, is a good thing, but a brother doesn't necessarily have to be your brother. But I guess you might have some problems with the fact that he didn't talk about the sisters as well, brothers and sisters and comrades. Could you talk about that concept?
Well, I think you're right. As a feminist, and I do see myself that way, although I also agree with those who try to separate themselves, like Alice Walker, I think, came up with the phrase womanist, and I consider myself a womanist. In other words, I believe in the equality of all peoples, women included. That's a really very simple position. But I think the issue of comrades and brothers was very, very important for two reasons. You see, because we in the African American community in the United States were somewhat divided and confused about how to understand what was going on in the African continent. In many of the former Portuguese colonies, for example, you had armed struggle and divisions. Look at Angola, look at Mozambique. Each of these countries had serious divisions between several sectors of Africans or among several groups of Africans. So I think what Cabral was trying to convey to us was that we had to give up this notion that just because you are black, you are automatically an ally. And I'm sure by now we have so understood that. Look at the present situation with the rise of this very small but vocal group of black Republicans or black conservatives. Now we are living that question in our blood, if you will. A comrade is someone who you can depend on to who has your, who shares your same ideological position, that's theory, but also acts on that in a certain kind of way and tries to live life according to those precepts that you both share, or that a, you know, a group of people shares. And so would I say that Jonas Savimbi, for example, of Angola, who sided with South Africa in that conflict in Angola, or at least allowed South African support, and I'm talking about apartheid South Africa, not contemporary South Africa.
Not the ANC South Africa. You're talking about the redneck apartheid South Africa.
Right, right. And that, how could I see him in the same way that I saw those people who were trying to break away from this regional yoke that apartheid South Africa had around the necks of Africans in the region? So I think that was that's the context of us trying to understand what was going on in Africa, and not really having ever had information. Look at what you learn in schools in the United States about Africa. It's very backward. Until you get to college and start majoring in African studies and get to graduate school and choose a country, choose a field that you're going to do research in and all of that, you don't really even get to read Africans. So I think that that was a very, very important distinction that he was making to us at that time.
Okay, we're speaking to Angela Gilliam, and the phone number here is area code 416-595-1655. We're going to open up the phones as soon as Miss Gilliam gets off the phone, because you have to go around half an hour, I guess. Not in a half an hour, but at 9:30 your time, which is 12:30 our time.
Right.
Okay, I'm going to turn you over to Mr. Harewood.
Good morning, Miss Gilliam.
Good morning.
Good morning. Miss Gilliam, I wanted you to maybe talk a little bit about the history of Amilcar Cabral. Who was he? Because he was really quite a remarkable individual. He was an agronomist by training, and that gave him a particular understanding of the country of Guinea-Bissau. Perhaps you can talk to us a little bit about who he was and chart his own political development.
Thank you for the question, but I must admit that I don't know in detail and depth the particulars of the life of Amilcar Cabral. What I can do is to describe to you my experience in living in visiting, under a safe conduct pass, Guinea-Bissau and Cabo Verde in the 70s, during this period of the strife in the former Portuguese colonies. I found Guinea-Bissau to be a very interesting small country, but with all of the problems of a colonial society, that is, that the, you know, trying to get independence and to change the values of the Guineans. My daughter happened to have gotten sick, and I went to we had to spend a lot of time in a hospital in Guinea-Bissau, and the hospital was private, for example, whether not open all the time on the weekend. If it weren't for a Cuban volunteer doctor, I might have lost my daughter. So when we were in the hospital, we saw that the peasants who came in to get treatment, you know, who wore blankets around them as cover, they were not considered as important as urban Bissau residents. There were a lot of foreigners who had businesses, and the indigenous African people had very, very few resources that would enable them to have access to the privileges and of the state. All of West Africa in the mid-70s was experiencing a drought. for example. So I could see how the infrastructure of colonialism really affected, especially the island country of Cabo Verde. People had to walk down to a boat every morning with buckets, and you had to fill up a bucket and trudge it to your residence just to have access to water. I never became so sensitive to water in my life, so that there were, because there was no infrastructure. And so I could appreciate the anger of someone looking at the difference between what foreigners could, how they could live, the kinds of food they could eat, the kind of health care they had access to in hospitals, and the assumptions about wealth, that these were more important people, as opposed to the average, typical Guinean or Cabo Verdeano. And it is that person who appreciated and worshipped Cabral, that person who, for whom he articulated what was wrong in the country. And Cabo Verde, by far, was one of the most exciting countries, just to the lessons that I learned from average, ordinary people in Cabo Verde. And I do write about this experience in Cape Verde in the chapter that Norman has mentioned, Mr. Richmond has mentioned, in Black Feminist Anthropology.
Okay, we're in conversation with Ms. Angela Gilliam. I want to ask you a very, I guess this is going to be one of the last questions, but the Cape Verde Islands is a place, that's where I think Horace Silver, his father was from the Cape Verde. He had that song, Song for My Father, and I think Tavares, that singing group, they were from the Cape Verdean Islands as well, or their roots were there. But Amilcar Cabral, I understand people like George Jackson, and I remember hearing Daruba Ben Wahad talk about how they came through socialism and Marxism through the struggles in Angola, Mozambique, and Guinea-Bissau. Some people couldn't relate to Karl Marx or Lenin because they were Europeans. But once they saw Africans who could relate to those ideologies, that ideology, they sort of took a second look at it. And you could you talk about the role, some of the positive and the not so positive things about Cabral and his interpretation of Marxism?
Well, you see, this is very complex, in part because Cabral is one of the few African thinkers of the period whose works we have access to in English. I remember asking a question of some friends who were African from either Mozambique or Angola. I can't remember which now. But are you going to write this down? This is, we would have an important discussion, and I'd say, oh my goodness, I wish people back home could hear this, because I was teaching in Portugal, you see, for a while, and there were a lot of students and or professors and different intellectuals from Africa who would come through Portugal, and I would get a chance to meet, and we would get into these discussions, and I'd say, well, are you writing this? He said, unfortunately, in our situation, we have to be designing and reconfiguring, Africa at the same time we should be writing, and writing suffers. So Cabral is one of the few who we have. If we just think of these figures, like Patrice Lumumba, or, you know, these figures who we would want to know what they think or they thought, we don't have access to them. And so Cabral has to be understood as we should be grateful to him, that for all of perhaps the areas of criticism one could make, that in fact he did leave us a record of his ideas.
Correct.
And that's very, very important. I remembered one of the things that I thought about for a long time was his view that people who had, and this was a kind of linear Marxism, that is, this stage is first, then you go through that stage, then you go through that stage, and so on. And I think what kind of upset African Americans is that the end result of development, that is, all these stages of development, would you'd still end up with an urbanized society that looked very much like capitalist countries. And I think, or you know, certain of the features that we felt were oppressive in under capitalism. But I still think that these ideas of Cabral were interesting. For example, he said that people who have, if you go around the world and you look at people who use the same kinds of goods or in from nature, from life, as clothing, as musical instruments, as source of spiritual power, etc., that those people basically are in the same, quote-unquote, similar modes of production, and they have similar ideas, whether they are from the Amazon or whether they are from Guinea-Bissau. And I can't remember, let me see, I think I have one of the places where he does discuss this, because in a book called Third World Women and the Politics of Feminism.
Yes.
I have a chapter in there called Women's Equality and National Liberation, and I quoted Cabral as for my last sentence. I said, he said in 1975, or at least from a book published in 1975, we must build a society on a scientific basis. We can no longer afford to believe in imaginary things. And I think he was especially concerned about the wind spirits, or you know, the forest spirits, or...